The earth is perfumed with scented water and strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, the four continents, the sun, and the moon. Imagining this as the Buddha riddle, I offer it so that all beings may enjoy that pure room.
In accordance with the capabilities and the diverse aspirations of sentient beings, I ask you to turn the wheel of Dharma with the greater or lesser of conventional vehicles.
As usual, I'm so happy to be here. I feel very close with this Sangha. As Kiki mentioned, there are many reasons. I feel like it's all like a family. Trungpa Rinpoche has been a teacher of mine for a long time. Not someone who I have so much personal relationship, although there's a little bit of that, but more that he's always been someone that I've gone to receive teachings from whenever he's around. And I've learned a tremendous amount from him, particularly teachings on the Middle Way or Mahamudra. And I cherish, you know, the moments that I've had with him. He's truly an extraordinary, one of the very realized teachers of that generation that we have left, which makes it all the more precious, you know. And I think one thing that is coming to my mind right now as I sit here is I appreciate very much that this Sangha and my community also studies the more traditional teachings. And I feel that I want to describe traditional because often nowadays traditional means like the kind of, I don't know, the older way of looking at things, something that's not current or... you know, those traditional Buddhists. How can I explain it? The ones who are not open, maybe, in some ways. Sometimes I feel this because I go to a lot of conferences, and I feel that there's a tendency to want to disregard some uncomfortable things about this path, which I think don't have to be uncomfortable, but just need to be opened up and explored. I went to one conference maybe a year ago or a year and a half ago where the main question for everyone was, is the Dharma in danger of getting watered down? And I felt, well, the Dharma is a path, and wisdom traditions often we lose them. It's happened many times. So what does it mean, you know, to keep something alive, you know? And I think it means that we have to get to the essence of it. We have to find what the essence of it is. And that's an ongoing question. It is for me. It's like, what is this path about? Why am I doing it? How can I bring it alive in my own experience? And I feel one thing that I rely on to help me do this investigation is the fact that I don't feel I have to deny or get rid of anything, or I have to cultivate anything. You know, a lot of people... or a lot of practitioners nowadays feel, for example, this faith is something that's not necessary on the path. And I'm not saying it's necessary or unnecessary. I just want to know what that is. Like, I want to look into it. What does that actually mean? You know, for example, if you look at faith, it's actually the ability to rest in the fact that we actually can't know anything in a determinate way. Chinle Norbu Rinpoche said, cows have faith in grass. we depend on other. We don't live in isolation. So because we're reliant on other, we have no choice but to wait. Well, faith, there's no way around it. So like I feel in this tradition, there's so much space for inquiry. There's so much space. So, there's a great quote in the... I'm sure you're familiar with the text, the Uttara Tantra, because Trungpa Rinpoche teaches this a lot. And he says, and in this text it says, there's nothing to reject or get rid of, and there's nothing to add. The nature itself, you know, when you see it, you know, then you have this sense of realization, you know. So we don't have to buy any of this. It actually, we don't have to have like a blind belief about anything, which is often associated with being traditional. But we don't have to doubt it either. Perhaps there's a whole other way of looking at things beyond belief and doubt. The Buddha often talked about that as eternalism or nihilism. Do we only have the choice of affirming or denying? You know? Or when our teacher gives us some advice that's uncomfortable for us, do we either have to blame ourselves or think the teacher is wrong? These are really big questions, you know? Is there room to have discernment, but also to be very open? This I think points to the spirit or attitude of self-reflection and investigation in this tradition. And if I were to think, when I was at this conference, someone was saying, well, you know, what is Buddhism anyways? Everywhere you look, the Zen and the Theravada and the Mahayana and the Vajrayana, they're all completely different, which I don't know if that's really the case. I question that myself. I think, actually, what runs through them, amongst many other things, is that it is a process of investigation and not a dogma. So we start with some kind of a coarse understanding of our world where we're reacting on impulse and we're not real clear about who we are in relationship to everything else. That's where we start. That's fine. But we because we're introduced to the Dharma, we learn, we gather some information, we have some hearing wisdom about how we might proceed, how we might look into the nature of the way we think, the nature of the way we see things, the nature of our world, and we start to ask questions about it. And this happens at the very beginning of the path. You know, when the Buddha said, well, let's look into suffering and its cause. Let's look into freedom, liberation and its cause. This is basically introducing a question for us, an investigation for us. Of course, first we have to prepare what I call prepare the lab. So if we're going to do a scientific experiment, we have to prepare the lab. So for me, that means doing some shamatha practice, some watching the breath, like calming the mind. So that's not so much of an investigation practice, but it's more how can we calm things down so that we could actually do some looking. Like if somebody has a very traumatic experience or is dealing with PTSD or something, it's very hard for them to just sit down and start investigating their mind because their nervous system is shaken. They're unable to relax enough to even see that what's happening, what they think is very true and real and they're continuously reacting to, is something that happened in the past. You know, it's not happening anymore. But their belief systems keep their narrative continuous. And they keep creating situations again and again. So that's something very important to investigate. But if you just tell somebody on the spot, oh, you should check into that, they're not going to be able to do it because just their nervous system and their physiology is holding all this trauma, which is why we have these incredible therapies nowadays, it seems, that are really helping people to get through that kind of coarser kind of trauma or belief system. So on this path, we have, you know, we have shamatha. It's like, how do we begin to touch it? Because really what I think the Dharma is first-person science. Do you know what I mean? You know, in classical science, we look at things which we think we're being objective. Of course, I'm not sure how possible that is. And we're trying to arrive at truths about a world outside of us. And we're trying to kind of disregard our subjective experience as much as we can, reduce it, and see if things occur again. You know, we do experiments many times to see if there are patterns and so forth, which, of course, I'm not putting down third-person science. You know, science is an amazing process. So here, there's something similar to what we're doing here to what they're doing in classical science, but what we're doing is we're including the way our consciousness works. They're including our perceptions, and we're really looking directly at how things are. So that's very... there's something very subtle that I think we have to learn about this, and I want to talk about it today, because how do we actually look at our own mind? You know, how do we do that, especially without judging, without reacting? You know, how do we do that with complete openness? And how do we look at others with complete openness? Or how do we take our teacher's words in and really let them work on us without contracting and start... you know, making it part of our story? You know, these are really deep questions, and these questions follow us throughout the entire path. It's like, in the beginning, how do we touch? We all have trauma, actually, as human beings. You know, trauma I often have described as undigested experience. You know, something happens to you. Maybe it happens very quickly and dramatically, like there's some sort of natural disaster, or we have a loss, somebody dies suddenly, or, you know, when we're a child and something happens to us and we don't know how to take it in. So, you know, with digesting food, you know, we ingest food, we process it, and we eliminate it. It's very natural, unless we're ill. But with our experience, I think we have... there's something that doesn't come naturally to us in terms of how we work with our experience. And we have a lot of wanting and not wanting and preferences and pushing and pulling. And we struggle a lot as human beings. So, you know, how do we take in information? How do we work with our belief systems? And I think actually the path is not a dogma. It's really very much an applied science, an applied investigation that really opens up into a very magical experience. And when I say magical, I don't mean not earthbound. That the magic comes from investigating what's right in front of us, what's a part of us, you know, what's in our daily life. Like a lot of times people ask questions like, how do you practice Dharma in daily life? How do you bring meditation off the cushion, you know, when you get up off the cushion? How do you, it's easy for your Dharma practice to run parallel to your life. Do you know what I mean? Not intersect, that the actual practice can actually not penetrate your experience at all. But then that means that in some ways we've had a misunderstanding about what this is. So we need to be very clear what this is. Sometimes I feel that spirituality can be so vague for us. We allow it to be vague. And we say things like, I heard at that conference, what is Buddhism anyway? You know, from a practitioner who's been studying and practicing for 30 years, this could happen to us. It's possible if we're not very clear about what we're doing. Do you know? So I think this path is anything but vague. It's the opposite of vague. But it requires a lot of work. Personally, for me, this is the most fun work I've ever had. This is like, I don't even know if I can call it work, but like this continued exploration of my mind and its world, and it just keeps opening and opening in the most magical way. So I feel very, enthused all the time when I think about the Dharma, like Gina was noticing. I could be very kind of relaxed in the afternoon, and all of a sudden, if you start to talk about the Dharma, all of a sudden I get all my juice back. Because there's something in it that's, you know, sometimes we feel, oh, we have to sit. There's all these shoulds and shouldn'ts. Oh, I should be sitting more. We don't think of Dharma as enjoyment. But in fact, once we kind of figure out what the Dharma is, if you feel really clear about it, it's actually a way to stop and enjoy your mind. Mm-hmm. Or you might don't even have to stop to enjoy it. It's a kind of understanding or a clarity and a practice that we can habituate our minds to, where it becomes kind of the place where we live. And so I really feel it's so important for us to see this as extremely practical, but magical too. So I want to get into that, and I only have 2 evenings. And I'm going to pack a lot into these 2 evenings because of what I've decided to teach, having talked to Gina a little bit, and something inspired me, and now I have decided, I'll tell you in a minute. But I want to just say a few things about beliefs. And I want to tell you just a kind of a simple story of something that happened to me last month when I was teaching a retreat with Anam Tupten Rinpoche. And in the evenings, around 7-ish, we had these, you know, it's a silent retreat, but then you get to meet with a group of 12 people each night, 12 different people, and Rinpoche and I would sit there, and people would ask us questions or talk about their experiences. So one lady started to cry really deeply, heavily. And she's crying and crying, and she's saying, I have so much pain. I have so much despair. I'm depressed, you know. I always have so much sadness. I'm a sad person. And when I watched her going through this, I could really see she was feeling some despair. And I know what despair, we all know what despair probably feels like. So it wasn't like I thought she wasn't feeling despair. But she had a belief about herself there, that she's a sad person. And I kind of didn't buy it. And I said to her, is that true? Are you really? Is it true? I kept asking her. And then, like, after a few minutes, I could see her kind of forehead crinkle. Like, and she kept saying, I have so much. But then she was trying to convince herself that she did. Like, actually, she realized that's not who she was. You know, when you have despair, you feel sad. And when you don't have despair, but to say that that's who you are, there's like a belief in there. There's kind of a realness to her despair. You know, we all have this. And then after 5 minutes, she turned to me and she said, you know, I don't actually think that's true. And I loved it because, like, right before my eyes, some kind of some kind of huge transformation. But this is kind of what this is about. You know, we have all these beliefs that we cling on to, but are they really true? It's not a denial of experience, but we constantly believe what we think, and we constantly believe what we feel, which is why it's so hard to sit and watch our mind and look at our mind. We sit to practice, and all these things come up, and moment by moment, we're kind of pushing away and grasping because we have this idea of this kind of truth of our experience, but really it continues to arise, express itself, and then, you know, dissolve, and every moment is so different. So in that sense, we're not very savvy about our experience. We see things in a very coarse way. And, like, do we want to keep doing that? It's so exhausting. You know, is there another way? So these are the questions as Dharma practitioners, like, we start to ask, is there another way? And yes, indeed, there is another way, you know? Another thing is, you know, just the way we see others, like the stories that we build. I don't know, the example for some reason I've been using is, like, you're married and you wake up and you trip over a pile of your spouse's dirty laundry or your roommate, something like that, on the floor while you're on your way to the kitchen to get a cup of coffee. So then it just kind of, it could go anywhere. You could just trip and then keep walk on. But no. Something happens, like you grab hold of that. Something becomes kind of like very vivid and real about that experience. And all of a sudden it goes like, whoa, 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 whoa. It spins fast, you know? Or like, vroom. Like your car's still, but you step on the accelerator. There's some momentum happens. And then you start to remember the crumbs on the counter, you know? The toilet seat up or down. No, up. Whatever. You know, all the little pet peeves you have about this person. Don't they care how I feel? Don't they know I live here too? Why do I have to do everything? Which is like, you know, maybe your particular, the way you have, the belief that you create around your life. And then because it starts to seem very real and true, you start to seal up all the holes in your argument. Like, you forget that they, what they did that was really wonderful for you. All those things you forget, and you start to patch up those holes and create a seamless story. And then there you are with this kind of true story, which is actually the next day when things change, you realize was a complete delusion. But we live like this. You know, we live like this because of this not understanding, even in that first moment, that we could just walk over the pile. And not to say we don't relate, but do we have to relate from that kind of delusion is the question. You know? So a lot of people think when you say it's a delusion, it means that nothing matters. This is how we think. Our mind is so dualistic. You know? We either have to affirm something is true or we have to deny it. We have to actually think something exists or then it's non-existent. You know? We either have to, you know, I don't know, think that, you know, we're not going to react, but that means we're not dealing with it. Are those the only two choices? Do you think we have other choices? Have you experienced other choices? But this, it's so interesting how when I've talked about this, people are always, but that means you're denying the situation. But the fact of the matter is, we have experiences of not reacting and of responding intelligently. And what happens when you're able to respond? Do you think your creativity is squelched, or is it more responsive and more creative and more unhindered and more compassionate and clear? Because this kind of reactive mind is not clear, and it only sees things in very limited, you know, ways. So it was interesting, when I was teaching with Anam Tubten Rinpoche, the theme was a lot about delusion for some reason during this retreat, which I actually think should always be the theme, because in a way, as practitioners, we're not just trying to feel compassionate, we're trying to use, you know, compassion is so emphasized because we're trying to pierce through some kind of delusion. It's too easy just to say, oh, Buddhism is about calming the mind and being compassionate. But it's much more than that. It has to do with really seeing clearly and stepping outside our belief system and our story, so we have this kind of intelligence and the unhindered compassion and love and skillful means to really live in a very different way, you know? So Anam Tubten Rinpoche said in the beginning of one talk, and I don't know if he's coming up in my mind lately a lot, I guess because I just came out of that retreat, but it was a very wonderful retreat, and he said, he asked, what sounds better to you, the magical display of awareness or the proliferation of thoughts? But this is kind of the choice that we need to make. And I feel what's interesting is we have to look at the nature of thinking mind. Like, what is that? What is the mind that knows? And how are we using this for our investigation into things? You know? Because obviously the thinking mind is very valuable to us. The discerning mind, we call prajna, right? And prajna in our tradition, prajna is not just limited to the Dharma or waking up, but prajna could be just a sense of discernment where you choose. You go to the grocery store and you choose things, or you use your prajna to decide where to send your children to school. Or prajna also has to do with examining, like, what brings happiness and what causes suffering. For example, you know, we use prajna to identify when we're grasping to the self and we're so self-focused and we're self-absorbed. You know, we're contracted and small and somewhat fearful and neurotic from that. When we start to serve others, we start to see a part of, I want to say our part of our mind, but it's not really a part of our mind. It's just what happens when we understand who we are in relationship. When we move out into an understanding of that we are part of this world that's interdependent, and that, you know, others' happiness becomes our happiness. It's like the science of that, you know, and we begin to cherish that experience, you know, those moments when we understand who we are in relationship. So prajna, actually our knowing mind or our cognitive mind, our awareness, you have awareness when you're confused, and you have awareness when you're not confused. It's just it's a little bit of a different quality to it, or quite a dramatic. You know, one is quite diluted and painful, and the other one is so unhindered and compassionate and intelligent, you know. We know these, the difference between these, I think. I think people know. We all have those moments of openness and clarity. So I think it's important to really look at the nature of things. And I want to, what I wanted to do tonight, you know, I'm quite interested in the Majjhimaka or middle way tradition. And I was talking to Gina last night, and she, I hear you've been studying those, the three investigations of looking into whether something is singular, looking into whether singular or many, whether you can find something that's permanent or impermanent, or whether you can find something that's autonomous or independent, meaning it's the same or separate from other things. Anyways, this might, I know there's a couple of new people here, and don't worry, I really try to explain this really carefully, because I think this is something we can all understand and work with. But there might be here and there some terms, and we can clear those up as it goes. But I just want to introduce what I've decided to do. So tonight I'm just going to give an intro and then talk about singular, the investigation on things, finding things that are singular. And tomorrow I'm going to do two, which is a little ambitious, but I feel they're quite, you know, I'm really seeing my teaching is changing a little bit, because I'm really seeing that the way people can understand this is to look in at their mind and investigate, rather than me, you know, or somebody else telling you what to do. And that's what the Buddha said we should all do, is examine our own experience. Don't just do it out of respect for the Buddha or respect for your teacher or respect for the Dharma, but do it that you should be looking at your own mind and your own experience in order to develop conviction. Confidence. This is a path of confidence, developing confidence. So first we develop confidence through doing shamatha practice, because when we stabilize our mind, it's not like, you know, they say, like a blind, limbless man on a wild horse, or person on a wild horse. Who can develop confidence when you're in that situation? So that's what an untamed mind sometimes feels like. You just get, you don't even know what to do with all that rich energy of the mind. And it seems to pummel you or come at you, or it's uncomfortable because we don't know, we don't understand what our relationship to it is. And then we start to investigate, you know, we develop confidence because we start to see, oh, you know, that actually we have the capacity to experience, you know, compassion, or like the Four Immeasurables, loving kindness, that we can have sympathetic joy, like when we see others happy, it sometimes makes us happy. And we start to see like how that is something we can rely on and how that enhances our experience. Like when you have an experience during the day where, you know, you are able to be kind to someone, and then you experience that aspect of your mind and that you have that, it can sustain you for the whole day. So Gina and I were speaking in the car how you begin to cherish these aspects of your own mind, and that gives you a lot of confidence. It's very practical and nitty-gritty on some level, but it's very magical, because what happens is you start to feel great joy, great confidence. So then in these teachings that I want to get into in the next two evenings, you know, we start to ask some interesting questions about our stories, about our belief systems, about these kind of even some unconscious belief systems that we have, like our self, me, mine. You know, we don't have maybe conscious ideas about the self, but there's always this like feeling of me, and it's often contracted. We think to protect ourselves it's like all contracted, but really, if you want to feel protection, you might look into the nature of things, and you might see that you can bear looking at what they are. It's like we have an assumption that things are what we think they are. But when you start looking at them, we start to see the nature of things in a very different way. So our fear gets reduced. Our assumptions about who we are, it gets easier to look at our mind. So that's what happened to that woman in Idaho. Despair, and kind of being really contracted and tight. And she started, is it true, actually? Wait a minute, maybe that's not who I am. Maybe that's the despair, it keeps changing, and it's not what I think it is. And then all of a sudden she had this kind of freedom and this kind of joy at seeing that, in fact, it's not what she thought it was. So in the Majjhimaka teachings, or these Mahayana teachings that we're going to get into, we want to investigate the nature of things and the nature of the way we see things. This is a way to gain confidence. Like my teacher has often said, if suffering really existed as some kind of solid, true thing, even the Buddha couldn't take it. The Buddha couldn't bear it. It's the fact that the Buddha looked into the nature of things and realized that things were not what he thought they were, that he was able to rest fearlessly with his mind, and he was able to take things in. And I'll just tell you kind of this is kind of at the essence of everything in the Dharma, even the Vajrayana Dharma. How big can we be to hold? How much can we bear? And I don't mean bear like grin and bear, but how can we begin to touch life, or touch our story, or touch our experience, and not be so afraid? You know, how much can we let it touch us? Like, I always talk about when I was in retreat, and I noticed for myself, you know, when I was in a long retreat at some point, and, you know, you go in and you feel like you can only bear maybe 10% of your experience, because there's so much discomfort. So when positive things come, or you have a moment of blissy, or you think about something nice, you know, your mind feels very bearable. But that's 90% that you kind of have trouble working with. And then as you sit more, so many thoughts and emotions come up. Like every evening you think, oh my God, how can I possibly experience any other? There's nothing else to experience, you know? But lo and behold, the next day, something new, you know? And sometimes it's very uncomfortable, and sometimes it's nice. But so then you start to kind of, it starts to wear down your kind of habitual mind a little bit. So you can experience 20%. Maybe you can experience 30%. Sometimes you kind of have this like, bring it on. You know, you feel fearless, you know, because you're ready. There's something happens where you have this kind of spirit of not being intimidated by your own mind, you know? And that's what this is about. It's like, how can we be big enough? And this is extremely empowering. And this is what brings confidence. So in the teachings I was teaching in Rochester this weekend, and one man said that he felt disappointed in emptiness because he thought it was going to take away his suffering. And that's not what this is about. This is about looking into the nature of suffering. Like, if you want your suffering to go away, how are you going to get rid of it? If somebody could have gotten rid of your suffering or our suffering, we would have done it a long time ago. That's not how this works. In fact, suffering is the product of incredible grasping and misunderstanding. So in order to work with suffering, we have to have a little bit of, you know, I want to say you have to have courage, but in a way you have to have information. You have to have a way of investigating. You have to have something that helps you look. That's what this path will do for you, you know? So, you know, this idea of not even wanting suffering, you know, I was saying to this man, I don't know if you've ever seen The Truman Show, that movie, but, you know, really try to imagine on some level what it would be like if there were no suffering. Everything worked out exactly the way you wanted it to. I just feel like life, you would be inert, like there would be nothing waking you up. I feel that the suffering is of value for us. It's not that I want to suffer at all. And it's not like I want other people to suffer. It's hard to see the suffering. But we need to understand the nature of suffering in order to have compassion. True compassion. And so, you know, I do sometimes try to imagine, you know, and I try to imagine what it's like to want to get rid of my suffering, because I don't think that's where I ever come from. I feel interested. I want to understand it better. You know, and that's, you have to have this to be a practitioner. You can't get rid of anything. Things arise due to causes and conditions. And so the point is, like, how are we going to work with it? You know, this is the question. What is the attitude and the kind of, I also want to say mindset, or what's our plan? There's a plan. And that's where the Buddha comes in, because he made a plan. He understood all this and he made a plan. You know, one thing that we really have to do, in a sense, because we have all these belief systems, is really look into the nature of prajna, or the nature of how we know. So we have kind of the aspect of our mind that needs to examine how we know things and how we're going to look at our mind, and that will help us understand what we're looking at. You know, our suffering, you know, or our joy, or anything. So, you know, I just wanted to say a few things about the nature of knowing, which is, I think, important to get into if we're going to start talking about doing an event. We're going to do an investigation tonight, like a guided, I'll guide you through it. We often think that knowing means to know the truth, like we can capture truth through knowing. Like, I know what this is, or I know who she is, or I know who I am. You know, this is maybe a misunderstanding that we have about knowing. You know, those are labels, or that's language that we agree upon to describe things. But actually, if you look at the nature of knowing, we don't ever capture truth through our awareness or our discernment. We can call awareness or discernment or our ability to cognize. If you look at it, the nature of knowing or the nature of discernment is that we have experiences. We're aware of them. They keep changing, but we make decisions based on those. But to capture truth never really happens. Like, has anybody ever captured truth? In science, you know, truth changes every single day. You know, what something is, what something means, how something is. Like this famous quote by one theoretical physicist that I love so much, he said that it's widely held in the realm of science that certainty is a failed historical enterprise. And I think that's true in the realm of science, in that even though people, when they're investigating, you know, because there's ego in it and there's wanting to find, reach conclusions and create some sort of, discover things. And discovering things finding things in science is a beautiful process. But I don't know about the conclusion part. It's like we can know and we can function without conclusions. That's what's interesting here, and this is up for questioning here. I'll just give an example. This is my new example. If I say to you, come here, you'll understand what that means, whoever you are. Phil. So as they come here, and you'll walk over to an approximate here. Of course, it can never be determined really where here is. You know, here is all relative. Here is different for everyone. My here, you know, you can't merge with the other person. You know what I mean? To be in their here, wherever that is anyways. So we have this kind of language, and we have this idea, and it functions so well. If Phil comes here, he can hand me something, or we can have a private conversation, or, you know, whatever. So it's all approximate. It's temporary. It's functional. But true, can you say? Can we ever reach a conclusion about where here is? We can't. So it's very interesting that we live in this world of language and ideas, and we agree, you know, that things mean what we say they do, like this is a clock for us, those of us who live in this culture, you know. This is the clock itself, even for animals, doesn't even have the, you know, they can't even relate to that. You know, we all have like our own world. We think there's the world, but nobody sees the world in the same way. It's so relative. You know, I always think too, we see the world, we've seen the world from space. So when we think of the world, we might even see it from this incredible perspective. But like for a dog or a bird or something, they don't even have the inclination to step back in that way and see the world. And our notion of roundness is a concept that we have. You know, but maybe round might be different for other people, you know, or other species. So it's all very relative. So we have these words, but truth is a whole, a different thing altogether. So we think often things are what we think they are, you know? And I think we get confused. So we have this tradition where we start to look into this a little bit more. We start to look into kind of our belief systems and the realness of things. And I want to just tell you a little bit about what this is and kind of the nature of that, and then I'm going to get more kind of, if this is getting a little abstract, I'm going to actually bring it to experience. So we have this tradition called analytical meditation. Does that sound fun? Nobody thinks it sounds fun. And nobody likes that term. And yet we use it, you know, but then we can also look into that a little bit. Like, this is what I love. We don't have to discard things. We could keep opening them up. Like, we're translators of our world. We're always translating. There's no such thing even as a definitive translation. Like, I went to a translators conference, and one very famous translator who works at Princeton and teaches at Princeton said, yeah, there's no such thing as a definitive translation because things continue to change. Words change. They mean different things, you know, in different contexts. So, you know, we all have an interpretation. Anyway, that's a little tangent. But let's look at this term analytical meditation just for a minute, because I think it might open something up for us. So when we think of analyzing, it kind of sounds cold, like sometimes we analyze things to death, as they say, or we reduce things to dust. It has this coldness to it. We break it apart, and then it almost seems like we don't have an experience anymore, or we've negated an experience. So often analysis has that kind of coldness to it. And on the other hand, often when we analyze things, we just create more things. So things get more and more complex. Like you have an atom, and then you break it open, and millions of things come out. You know what I mean? So science seems really complex in the way they explain things and quantum physics and all. Who can understand any of that? Except, maybe they're understanding something. I don't know. But it's very complex. So, you know, we have this complexity. So why bother? You know, it just keeps seeming to get more and more confusing. But I looked up the word analytical, and I found the Greek root. Do you know anybody what it is? This is the best thing that I found on the internet. It means to loosen. It means to loosen. Loosening your concepts, loosening your beliefs of what you think things are. Loosening, you know, when you're loosening something like a physical thing, like if you're taking anything apart, it also loosens up the ideas you have about it. That made me really intrigued. That I could get into, loosening, not being so tight around my belief system. So, you know, I often think about things being complex when you analyze them, and I think, well, they get really complex when you're trying to find an answer, you know? But if you're willing to have things open, it really makes things simple and interesting. If you're able to bear that kind of openness. It's not easy for us to bear openness. Like, we always want to conclude things about ourselves and others. Like, when we sit to practice and we have something come up, it's uncomfortable. The reason we can't sit with it is because we've reached some kind of conclusion about it. It might not even be that conscious, but we just kind of contract. We're not open to looking deeper and letting it open. You know, that's just on a practice level. On a practice level, we're constantly shutting down around who we think we are, who we think other people are, and it gets really gross, and it turns into kind of fundamentalism, the inability to bear diversity or to bear the complexity and kind of open dimensionality of things. We kind of see things in a one-dimensional way. So, you know, the spirit of investigation in this tradition is, it's almost like if you were looking through a microscope at something, or a telescope without an agenda. You know, just being kind of amazed, you know, open to see what's there, you know, just phenomenally, you know, or being on a ship and washing up on a distant place that you've never been, uncharted territory, you know, and just be interested in what you see, you know. It has this kind of adventurous quality about it. So, you know, the mind, this is what the mind does. I often think of an atom as an interesting way to understand this. Like, an atom used to mean the thing that's not breakable. But, of course, now we break it all the time. How we break it, not literally, but it's like somehow we open it up and many things come out. And if you look at those things, many things come out. And if you look at those things, many things come out. You know, there was a period in the 1950s where science was breaking up, you know, when the atom was kind of broken, or they saw that it could break. It was called the particle zoo, because so many things came out. Now, are they really things that are coming out, or is it just our mind keeps opening? You know what I mean? Anyway, that's a matter of, you talk to a scientist about that, because I can't say for sure. But anyway, it says something about the nature of our thinking. You know, that we that things keep changing, that they keep opening. And can we bear that? And can we enjoy that? You know, can we enjoy that process? So we're going to start looking and investigating things so that when things arise in our mind, we don't feel like we're doomed. We're stuck. This is the basic premise of doing these investigations. We're constantly feeling doomed, like that lady in Idaho felt doomed. But then when she started to question, she realized she's not doomed at all, because the nature of the thing that she was looking at wasn't so solid. But to her, it felt like this thing. Do you know what I mean? Thoughts always see in things. Despair, that's a thing. Or bad me, that's a thing. Or we look at somebody else and we say, you know, arrogant, that's a thing. Or an iPod, me, mine, it, I don't know, a swarm of bees, that's many things that become, you know, a thing, but it's still a thing. Actually, in the Buddhist teachings, we call those skanda, we call that skandas, like we lump things together, you know. But that's what thoughts are. And I want to just say right here, I don't think thoughts are evil. You know, we have a tendency to think maybe that the conceptual mind is hindering our spirituality. But I think this is a tradition that honors the conceptual mind. It honors, the thoughts aren't the problem, but when we think the thoughts are true, we have a problem. Do you see the difference of that? So that something arises is not necessarily a problem, and thoughts are our way out of our confusion, in a way. Our discernment, our prajna, our conceptual mind, is what we navigate our confusion with. And we recognize wisdom, and we see cause and effect, and we analyze things. We loosen the tight concepts that we have about the world that we live in, our mind and its world. So this is very beautiful in that way. So what we're doing today is, I want to look at the nature of thoughts, because I want to look at how we make everything a thing. It doesn't have to be a problem to make... Actually, we use things to open up things, and I'll explain what I mean by that. We're going to use this propensity we have. Like, for example, in the teachings, we're going to examine the self a little bit in a minute, but we see self as like this very, we experience the self as this thing, but it's a very vague thing. But when we feel bad about ourself, it becomes like this thing. We make it a thing. We make our confusion a thing, our despair a thing. But when we start to look into that thing, we might not see that it's so solid as we think it is. But we see it as very singular. So it's kind of like a map. So say you have a map and you go to a trailhead. And when you get to the trailhead, the map doesn't look anything like the trailhead, right? When you get on the trailhead, you see rocks and birds and bees and hiding places and maybe cave-like things and shortcuts, and it smells nice and there's a breeze and, you know, it's teeming with life and it's very alive, you know? It's nothing like the map. Now, the same thing can be said for any one of those things. For example, if you look at a tree, is it a map? Can you see how the tree might be a map? If you look into a tree, it's made of a trunk, branches, pine needles, pine cones. You know, then if you take a that, so it's a map, but when you walk the territory of the tree, you see it's many things. It's not singular anymore. It's not just a singular thing. It's made of parts. So this is one way to analyze, a very simple way. We're analyzing. This is just analysis. You have an idea, and when you start looking into it, it loosens and it opens, and you find other things. It's very simple. We do this all the time, I think. And if we were to look into a pine cone, we find petals and like fibers and sticky stuff, sometimes seeds of some sort. I don't know that I could look up the language on the internet for that. Anyway, we find that pine cone is simply a map for a collection of parts. And then if you were to even go further to the atom, as long as you say it's a thing, it's going to have parts. That's what's interesting about concepts. So we're trying to capture in a concept, but as long as we think it is a thing, which is all we can do with conceptual mind, it has parts to it. And that's why they keep breaking them open, but never getting to anything essential, because as long as you grasp something essential, it has to have some kind of thingness. It's a conceptual. So always open. And so this is not a problem, as long as we're willing to keep opening and living that way. Living in an open question. Knowing that life will never reach some sort of definitive conclusion. We're always going to be a work in progress. And that's a beautiful thing. Because we don't want to be inert. We don't want to be stuck, you know. I don't think that that's really what we want. So there's this sense of investigate. This is one way that we investigate things. So we use other aggregates to break grosser aggregates. Like we look at the map, that's a solid singular thing. But then we look at the map, we start to find other things, and other things, and other things. It's not going to stop. So we can't really find anything. We can't really conclude with any singular thing. Does that make sense? This is going to get easier, and tomorrow it's going to get even easier. I promise. Sometimes I think this first one is the hardest. But this one kind of blows my mind, because it makes me realize that things are not what I think they are, and it helps me understand what is the nature of my thoughts and how beautiful it is to have thoughts and to really honor the process of discernment. Like, I really trust. I come to trust my discernment. What I don't trust is when I think I'm right. I don't trust that in my mind, that I think I really know. Or I can tell, you know, it might sound like that's what I'm doing now. I'm just describing my investigation. You shouldn't just believe it. You have to do it. And then see what you feel. you know? But I've never been able to find a singular thing. You know, each time I look at what I think is a thought, a singular thing that I'm capturing in my thought, it keeps opening. And all the great masters of the past have not found a singular thing. So it's like a looking and not finding and being amazed at what you see. That's what this practice is. But you have to look because you might find something. And if you do, then please do tell. You will maybe write a book. But I feel in science this is what we're trying to do. We're trying to find a singular thing that created everything else. But as long as you have a thing, things are going to keep coming out of it. So good luck to them. But the process, those scientists that are into the process are really fabulous. They're so full of life because they see how amazing everything is. You know? They can bear that kind of amazement. Like there's this one scientist, Marcelo Gleiser, I don't know if you've read his book, The Island of Knowledge, but he says, the bigger the island of knowledge grows, so do the shores of our not knowing. You know? That's the same principle. You know, so I think there are these wonderful explorers in every field of exploration who understand this principle and really cherish this. It's a way of being, it's a way of engaging, it's a way of knowing who you are, too. If you think you can know things in any kind of conclusive way, you might not really understand who you are in relationship to the world. It's not really an accurate assessment of how things are. I realize this is kind of a... Are you following?
Yes.
I want to make sure. I don't want this to get too abstract, so I want to go into the investigation. And I'm trying to decide what I want to make the object of our investigation. I think, you know, we'll concentrate on the self in all three investigations. That's what I just decided. And these are three different ways of investigating the self. So we're going to investigate the self tonight in terms of trying to find a singular self, something that's singular. So, you know, we're going to start with our body and we're going to see if we even just on a sensory level can find something singular there. So what I think I'll have us do, then Phil will make, Peter will make dong and a gong sound, and then we'll just do a little bit of shamatha practice so that kind of relax the mind. Of course, probably at the end of the day, maybe the mind is a little too relaxed, but I'm worried. But maybe keep your eyes open when you do it, and then I'll start to speak, and then all you have to do is kind of look as I speak, which is some, I don't know how you feel, but I really like when somebody does that kind of work for me and I get to just follow it. But really look. So don't give this investigation over to the conceptual mind that wants to reach a conclusion. What's the beauty of this is really look directly and try to find these singular things, okay? Really try to find. Don't just cling to the map. Really look. You're the only one who can see what this is. Okay? Peter. So let's begin by bringing your attention to the very top of your head. we're going to first look for ourself, a singular self in the body. And just move your awareness very slowly downwards. Let yourself experience a sensation in your body. And also you'll find that you have kind of a visual image of what's happening there, because you're not really seeing your body, but in your mind's eye, when you're visualizing and you're bringing your awareness to something, there's some sort of picture happening. So you just bring your awareness down. Sometimes you'll be focusing on the sensation, but there'll also be most likely some visual image going on there. And just see if you can find something that's singular. You know, see if even you can experience your awareness can hold your whole body at once, or are you only able to see a little piece of it at a time? You might see when you start to scan and explore, you know, the areas of your body, there are places of concentrated energy there. So focus even on that aspect and see if you can't even find, for example, if you have a little bit of pain or a little bit of kind of almost sensation, strong sensation there, if you can even find that place of sensation that almost feels like it has a sense of self about it. You know, can you find the boundary, a very clear boundary of that place? A singular place, like a singular feeling of pain that you might identify as a self. Might find when you look that in one of these areas, what you thought was, you know, what you called pain or discomfort, or maybe pleasure, has, when you look into it, when you bring your awareness to it, you might find a flurry of sensation, like many, many things going on, changing all the time, moving around. See if you can't isolate one of these sensations, just like a moment, what you consider a momentary sensation or a very fleeting thing. And continue to, you know, move down and see if you can find in your body something that you can identify with. It's like a singular self or a singular thing that you identify with as self. You might find, you know, in your chest that there's a sense of kind of grasping to the self or some kind of discomfort in a certain part of your body, and you think, oh, that must be self. Again, focus on that. See if you can find some kind of singular thing there. And then look at your this sense of I that you have. You must have some kind of concept or conceptual idea of me, singular me. And look into your experience and see, can you find that? Can you capture that? Different images or different concepts will arise. See if you can find something that you can identify. Or do you find when you look into things, you just see more things opening? Look into one of those and see if you can find the sense of I or self in one of those moments of experience. Notice how when you're looking for things at times, you tend to lump, because we're labeling things. For example, think the body. Notice how there's an idea of the body, although it has many different sensations and many different parts, that we see it as a singular thing. Notice if you do that or how you do that. Do you experience your body as a singular thing, or is there a lot of movement in how you know your body or are aware of your body? Then you might think, well, I can't find one singular self, but maybe self is many things. See if you could find self in the many sensations in your body, the many kind of moments of experience or consciousness. See if you could find the many, self in the many. And then begin to bring your awareness back to your breath. Did anybody find a self or a thing? A singular thing? Don't be shy if you did. She did.
No,
oh, I was so excited. I've been waiting. Yeah.
Well, I mean, thing that feels, that actually does feel singular, is, you know, basically like mission control. Like, I feel like there's mission control there. Mm-hmm. And that mission control is, you know, looking around, relaxing, whatever. So, and then, you know, sometimes I'm trying to look at mission control, you know, but that's, yeah, that's what it feels like. That,
yeah. Can you find a mission control, though? Oh, we're going to look much harder tomorrow. Yeah.
Go back.
Yeah. Mission control, you might notice, if it's awareness, changes with its phenomena. So there's like, it's hard to find a singular mission control. And this is what we're really looking for. There still feels like a self. You know, we're still grasping. There seems to be something that's continuing. We really need to look deeper. But we'll do that more tomorrow. You know, I think it's very, I don't know how this is for you, but looking and not finding is kind of mind-blowing to me, because we're looking and not finding, and yet we're having an experience, a very vivid experience, like, seems, well, let me open this up to you and let me hear what you say, and then I'll get back to this. I don't want to say what I think.
Well,
yeah.
Maybe it's a case we talk about looking and not finding, but what I was coming up with is a lack of conclusion. I wasn't sure that I was.
Right.
I wasn't finding anything, but I wasn't sure I was not finding.
Right,
anything.
Exactly. Yay. That's, yeah, perfect. Yeah, that's, yeah, wonderful. Anyone else want to say anything about it? Did other people have that same experience? It's like you're looking, you can't say it's nothing, but you can't say it's something, right? You can't affirm, but you can't deny.
No hard edges.
No hard edges there. Yeah, no defining boundaries on some level. Yeah, Phil, what do you think?
I think there was a little bit of sort of not trusting, so to speak, the not finding, and you know, what Tom was saying, sort of, well, did I find something or did I not find something?
Yeah.
Sort of not quite trusting that experience in the sense of, like, I need to keep going.
Yeah, this is a good. Yeah, did you have a question?
No, I just had one of the observations I had, experiences, and that was when you said my body, or there was just the concept of my body at some point, seemed so funny to me.
Yeah.
That, you know, that who's my, and whose body, and it brought up actually some sort of internal laughter, the concept.
It is, I think it's funny, isn't it?
It's funny.
In the back, there's someone, a commenter.
I feel like what I bounced up against was, I don't know what I'm looking with or how to look, and what's looking seems to be concepts. Like, as you said, when you look, you're scanning and you have like a visual image. So I feel like I'm putting these concepts out there and then trying to look through them or with them or for them. That was what I was aware of, was that I didn't really know how to look.
But you can't, with your awareness, you know, maybe you might be getting too philosophical too. It's so simple. But of course, like, we're going to get into we're going to look for awareness tomorrow. So that might be nice to see. But like, you know, we're aware. We have awareness. You know, and that's what we have to look with. And it's not that the concepts, you know, we're saying the concepts are bad. In fact, I'm not saying this is a totally non-conceptual practice. In fact, we're creating more concepts, for example, and I'm saying using those concepts are helpful, because we're creating more skandhas to break apart the grosser skandha. And what we're arriving at is, we can know. We can even have labels. And that's all no problem. It's just holding on to something that's true is the problem. So to think your thoughts are what you, the thing itself is a problem. So we can have beliefs and awareness, and we can use our discerning mind. We can have prajna. That's not really an impediment, you know. It's just that grasping to them is true. That's a problem. Like Talopa said to Naropa. Yeah, I think it was Talopa said to Naropa. You know, son, it's not the appearances that are binding you, but it's just the grasping that's binding you. So we can feel, in some ways, this is like a tribute to conceptual mind. It's the beauty of it and the illusoriness of it. So what, you know, in some ways, you know, we're talking about the difference between a delusion and an illusion. You know, like Nagarjuna said, it's like a dream, it's like an illusion. It's like the city of Gandhar, like a dream, like an illusion. This is what birth, this is what living, this is what dying is meant to be. So a language and ideas and discernment is all this beautiful illusion. So it's no problem as long as you see it as an illusion. But when you start grasping to things as true or thinking that things are the same as what you think of them, that's a delusion. You see what I mean? So we're doing this to see what, to look, to understand the nature of conceptual mind in a way, I feel. Does that make sense to you? Yeah. Yeah, in... Yeah, things like, who knows, are you saying like you feel the interdependence of things or?
Yeah, like interdependence, and then when you said like awareness, is it awareness expressing or is it
interdependence? Well, yeah, this is the thing, is that we're not finding any it. So it's kind of an interesting challenge to think like that, this, because it's saying we're looking and we're not finding, and yet behold experience, behold appearances. So in a way we're trying to philosophically make sense of this through our usual habitual way of trying to find an it that's doing it. But what this is saying is, who says that things either have to be affirmable or deniable? Who says things have to exist or not exist? You know? Those are conceptual. That's like a lens that we look through. We think we have to do either this or that. But all we're doing is looking at our direct experience and saying what we saw. We look, but we can't find anything intrinsically there. And yet, things are appearing and arising, and they seem to appear and arise, we say, through causes and conditions. So, for example, you know, we often use the analogy of a rainbow. Because a rainbow, as we know, I can't explain it too technically, but, you know, a rainbow requires, like, the sun and the rain and, you know, air and somebody perceiving it. And we often say, like, I always joke, because in Creston, where I live, there's so many retreat centers with different temples. And then the rainbow comes out. We have so many rainbows in the summer. So everybody says, oh, the rainbow is over our temple. But in fact, you know that the rainbow doesn't actually have in a location you will ever find. You know, it depends where you stand and like what your biases are too. So you can't really catch it. You can't, it's like that here thing. You know, come here. There is actually, this is so magical, I feel. It's so magical. You can't say it doesn't exist, but you can't say, you can't locate it. You can't catch it. You can't touch it. And yet, and everything is like that. That's what Nagarjuna is saying. This is what birth, this is what living, this is what death are. We're supposed to see it like that. This is what we're learning. And if you start to look at your own you know, your own existence and your own experience. Like, it's so magical like that. I was saying the other day somewhere that I've studied this for a long time with my teacher, and I used to say, Rinpoche, you know, how could things be apparent but not exist at the same time? And you say, Lizzie, it's magic. And I used to think, to just privately to myself, what kind of explanation is that? Like, because I it was abstract for me. But then I started doing a lot of investigations, and indeed I found this to be the case. I looked and looked and looked, and I could never find. It just kept opening and opening. I couldn't find anythingness. I couldn't find any self. I couldn't really find what I could say, a singular body. But here I'm functioning. We're very functional. Here functions, rainbows function. You know, we're incredibly functional. And not only functional, but certain causes lead to certain results, like apple seeds create apple sprouts and trees and fruits and all that. You know, there's some kind of consistency. So it is magical. Rainbows have those special colors and shapes, and so maybe there's another way to look at our whole existence. And maybe it doesn't have to be true, you know? So you have to say, like, who told me, like, why do I have to believe that things have to either be affirmed or denied? Why do we have to believe that things either exist or not? And this is the middle way. This is what the Buddha said beyond eternalism and nihilism. Eternalism means something exists, or it's something that can be affirmed. And nihilism is something that doesn't exist and is completely, like, non-functional. Or, of course, you can't have existence without it's interdependent. Like, non-existent depends on things existing. So that Mipham Rinpoche says, and I love this quote so much, Mipham Rinpoche was a great teacher, lived in the end of the 18th century? Oh gosh, sorry, I'm so bad at that sometimes. But he said, our minds think very dualistically. It's like an elephant. Elephant rolls in the water to wash off the mud, but then has to roll in the dirt to dry off. Like, it's from existence to non-existence, affirmation to denial, true or untrue. Here, we're actually relying on a direct experience to see how things are. And so this is very valuable, because when we sit to practice and this thing comes up, do you understand what I mean by your thing or a thing? You know, we contract around it. We think it's a singular, things always are singular, or singular always are things. Concepts always come in that kind of package, like a skanda or a lump. So we just assume that it's there, and we don't question it. So in this aspect of the teaching, it's like we're actually questioning the way we see, the way we grasp onto things, and we're not... And we're starting to see that, wow, that maybe they don't exist as we think that they do in the singular intrinsic. So we're not doomed. We're not stuck. It loosens our neurosis. You know, like if we tripped over our spouse's clothes and we remembered that things are not what we think them to be, and if we didn't contract and we didn't get all kind of thinking that we are right, we would have access to our intelligence and be able to relate to the situation in a different way without getting deluded. But it's just that right there where we start to believe in the way that we do, that we get kind of confused. And that's how delusion is spun, you know? So that's why we don't want to spin it. We want to not spin it. And we have to be able to bear not reaching a conclusion about it. Like this gentleman was saying, is it possible that we don't have to affirm it or deny it? Is there another way? And clearly, our intelligence comes out from that other way. Or maybe not clearly. This is something we have to examine deeply. And that's hence we have these teachings. So it's interesting in that this is maybe a little bit for more of the advanced folks here, but you know, we we talk about that there's no subject and object and all this thing in Buddhism. But what if you want to say that there is a subject and object in a more enlightened way or a more wisdom way, you can say that the subject, the perceiver, the awareness is that which can bear, that it can't know anything in a determinate way or intrinsic way. The object is dharmata, and the subject is the jnana or the wisdom. So you can use those, that kind of language to talk about a subject and object in knowing their true nature. So we're talking about really the practice itself, the place to rest, is that place that doesn't shut down around conclusions, like the open question. Is a very, and there's tremendous confidence comes from this, tremendous like conviction, but it doesn't have to be rightness. It's just conviction that comes from having done these kind of contemplations. And when these really scary things or these really intense things arise, we realize, oh, what a mess it makes when I actually hold on to them as real. What a mess it is when I, you know, have something come up and I react to it, that I forget what it is, you know. What a mess it is when I think I know somebody else. We're talking in the car. It's like a disrespect to think you know who someone else is. How wonderful it would be if we could accept, you know, others and enjoy others, because they're just, you know, rising due to causes and conditions. They're expressing their nature and then they're dissolving. And it doesn't mean we should be stupid about how we relate to them or not create boundaries. That's part of the fun of it. You'll be playful. There's lots of possibilities unless you shut down and you get reactive. Then you don't have any choices at all. So we can enjoy the appearance because it's illusory. You know what I mean? That makes it possible for us to kind of enjoy life in such a special and magical. It's so magical. So that's a lot of really what this is enjoying the magical, illusory quality of our experience. I feel it takes a long time sometimes to understand what this means. But that's why we do this. So this is a very significant part of the path. And, you know, cutting, when we talk about seeing through delusion, you know, this is a lot of what we're talking about. Very much the basis of the Vajrayana. Very much the basis of pure perception and all of that. So let's open it up just a little bit for some discussion. And Peter's going to start.
I so appreciate you bringing that idea that we have this mistrust of our conceptuality, or it's me very much that way. And somewhere along the line, I got it in my head that it's like it became a fixed point that conceptuality is. My own conceptuality is untrustworthy.
Yeah.
And just to be pointing out that this can be more playful and more.
Yeah.
And I mean, I came to a decision, a rigid point, that excessive conceptuality is untrustworthy rather than continuing. So I appreciate you pointing that out.
Are there, Peter, are there parts of it where you understand not to trust? Like, when do you know whether to trust and not trust?
Well, I guess I would call it excessive conceptual.
Excessive.
Spinning.
Yes, okay.
You know.
Yeah.
But I could shut down the process too soon, come to find out.
Yeah, this is an important topic because we can really appreciate the natural quality of our natural intelligence, you know? Yeah. I appreciate it. Let me say one more thing, and then I'll get to Eric. I think also there's another component to this that makes us trust our conceptual mind deeply, and that is, you know, we start to examine what creates happiness and what creates suffering from the very beginning of the path. And like in the Hinayana, or the very beginning of the path, we have very gross kind of vows. Like we have the 10, it's almost like the 10 commandments, like the 10 virtuous and the 10 non-virtuous, and that's because we have some confusion as to even those basic vows. Like sometimes you know, speak as speaking, gossiping, or harsh speech, or even killing, like with other beings, small insects and things like that. Like killing, not killing seems like a no-brainer for most of us, but actually when you start to examine, you take those vows and you start to examine, you see, oh, there's some subtlety to those. So we start at the very beginning of the path to refine our understanding and to sharpen our discernment, and it's, and to understand how to use that to navigate, because we want happiness, we want freedom, we want kindness. So this helps bring us out of our delusion. Then in the Mahayana, they say things get a little less black and white because we're starting to see that all concepts are empty, or they're, we can't really find an intrinsic truth. So then we have to depend on our motivation, and we have to see, oh, we have to become more clear about what motivates us. And since we strive for happiness, we start to think about others and use our relationship with others to develop and to mature on the path. And so we become more refined. Like we start to really look inside. It's not just actions and rules anymore, but it's like, how do we identify in ourselves when we're full of it and when we're not? When we're selfish and when we're generous, you know, when we have the sense of fundamentalism and rightness, or whether we're being open. So part of the path too, in our ability to have conviction and trust ourselves and our own discernment, has to do with a lot of investigation and examination and practice too. So, you know, this is all a big part of what we're doing. But so much confidence and conviction comes from this, and so much refinement of our own clarity. And then when we start to look and not find too, you know, then that increases even more, you know. So Eric, did you?
What I find helpful about the exercise is even when I feel like I'm not doing it correctly, or there are times I feel more successful at it than others. Either way, I find the active mind is quieted down during that exercise. I don't find myself getting angry about whether I'm finding something or not finding something. I'm not getting sad about it. I'm not reacting strongly one way or the other. And I find that really helpful because it suggests that with enough practice doing that, I can take that externally into the world and meet difficult situations having practiced not finding and therefore not react so strongly to whatever I'm feeling.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Yeah, I find it very powerful too, and also very enjoyable to look and not find. I find that a very enjoyable practice, like magic practice or something. And there's no like agenda. Like it's so, it brings it to the simplest, the mind to a very simple point. You know, no one's telling you what to do. You're just looking directly at something. You don't have to come up with anything brilliant or anything. Your conceptual mind doesn't have to contrive anything. It's just you're seeing what's there or not, or between is and is not. It's hard. Words sometimes are hard, but yeah, exactly. Yeah, Gina.
I'm just wondering if you could use some different words. Words can sometimes be elusive and just not quite sure what they mean.
Yeah.
So I was thinking of the word looking.
Yeah.
Great
question.
I'll repeat it
so it gets on here too.
I think sometimes the word looking is challenging for people, and I'm not sure if this was the case with Amy's question, but I'm really interested in her question, which I think was, I'm not sure if I'm looking, or I'm not sure if I'm, what was it, Amy?
Yeah, what is it that I'm using to look? What is looking?
She wasn't quite sure she was doing it, it seemed to me, and I've had that experience too.
I see.
So I'm wondering if it would be helpful to find some different words for looking. So even when leading ourselves in this investigation.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think I should repeat it? for them. Oh, okay. Gina was asking if I could find it, if I could describe or open up. See, this is the beauty of this. It's just like opening up. What else can we work with? You know, how can we be creative with this exercise? She wanted me to talk about looking. And she's kind of wondering who is looking or what is it that's looking. Right, too? Isn't that what you said?
Not so or much about that. Or maybe that, I mean, that's...
Yeah.
That's.
But what does it mean to look?
Actually, look. Because,
yeah.
I mean, look is one of our dominant senses.
Mm-hmm.
But not everybody...
Yeah.
That's not natural
yeah.
for everybody. And
yeah.
one of the things you said as you were leading us is, I think, bring to mind the visual of it. And for some people, including me sometimes, like... I'm not having a visual.
Yeah.
But I can still investigate.
Yeah. Sure, I understand. Yeah, actually, I'm really glad you asked this question because you could almost say feeling.
Mm-hmm.
You could say hearing or smelling or tasting. You know, it's like engaging your experience, you know?
Just the word experience.
Just the word experience.
Yeah. What are you experiencing?
Yeah, what are you, yeah, what are you, you can ask, what are you experiencing? Yeah. Yeah, you could ask that. It's whatever your yeah comes to your experience in that moment. You investigate and you see, right? You know, we had a kind of content, or we had a particular exercise. We're trying to look for the self, or we're trying to look for kind of thing. Really, we're looking for thingness here. You know, singularity or thingness or singular self. But it's an interesting word. Look. I heard Dzogchen Rinpoche, I was in some teachings with him this summer, and he was teaching a Dzogchen text, and it kept saying, look, look. And somebody asked him, what does that mean? He just said, meditate. But that's also, you know, what does that mean? You know, so I'm trying to be actually a little bit more specific what it means to look. And in this particular context, it means this really direct experience that doesn't try to reach a conclusion.
About direct your mind.
Yeah, or attention
still,
or awareness. Yeah.
That's still abstract.
Well, it's words are hard in this way.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah, in some ways it's... I'm trying to think what it is for me. Yeah, just bring your awareness to or bring your attention to. It could be... Yeah, and look, I don't mean... That's what I mean by look. Bring your attention or awareness to something.
It's almost like placement.
Uh-huh.
Like placing your awareness.
Yeah, placing your awareness on.
On a location.
Uh-huh. And that's why they say mindfulness
there.
On, you know, or... Yeah, I guess different words work for different people. But for me, and this is why I said this before, that when I'm having, even placing my awareness on my, for example, my head, I do have a visual image that comes with that a little bit. It's usually subtle, and I can feel at the same time. But usually when you're placing it on something, you have to have a concept to place it. So there's some subtle kind of visual thing happening there. Internal, like a imaginary. But often that accompanies the looking. And sometimes most of my focus is on sensation. Like with this particular exercise, I focus more on sensation, I feel, for myself too. And I try to lead it that way because it's a little bit easier to have attention on the physical. Like it's a little more concrete, it's less abstract. Actually, it's not really. You know what I mean? It feels like it's less abstract. But it's just as the way we see our body is so abstract, actually, in a certain kind of way. You know, we have these ideas about it. Like, I always try to imagine to experience my whole body at once, and I can never do that. Or try to imagine this, like, try to identify where your shoulder becomes your arm. Can you ever find that place? You know, locate that? So we have these ideas, like we break things into parts. But when we start to look at how we really experience our body, or how we experience anything, we find that it's quite different than what happens up in our conceptual mind. So that's so interesting. You see what I'm saying? So in some ways, this is bringing this away from abstract mind into a more direct relationship with how we actually experience our life.
Yeah.
But we get caught up, and it's like a movie. You know, there's so many frames, and then it spins fast, and it seems like a real thing happening. Or like if you have a stick of incense, and you go, wah, wah, wah. It's just a stick of incense, but it looks like a circle if it's dark. So we start to see things in this kind of coarser way, an unexamined way. And we react to stuff based on that. But in fact, do we really experience things like that when we really look and we see how we're experiencing things? It's not what we thought at all. And that just blows me. It's like knocks my socks off. I can't believe that, like, when you look a little more closely and you move out of abstract, you have this unbelievable connection. It is very magical and interconnected, but you can't find, but it's still arising, and you can't affirm, and you can't deny. In your mind, it is not grasping in that place. It's the mind of an open question. That's where that title comes from. Yeah. Phil.
What was coming to mind is we've been studying this text by Namapanaka Thera. Mm-hmm. He's a Theravadan monk, and he talks about the four foundations of mindfulness, and one of them being on the body. And he uses this term bare attention, which I think has been very helpful to me.
That's nice. Mm-hmm.
And so that it's essentially just looking at whatever is arising in our experience, mm-hmm. internally and externally. Mm-hmm. Without any admixture of it's just bare attention.
Yeah.
And it's been very helpful to me, and I think a lot of people in our sangha.
That's nice.
It's like just the facts, ma'am. You know,
what's
there.
Right.
Yeah,
that's very helpful. It's helpful to see also how the mind has its tendency to grasp and what it does, you know? It's helpful, I like that very much. I find it helpful to also look at the tendencies, yeah. The need to affirm or deny, you know? We really have that so strongly. It's so hard to bear it. It's so hard to bear being open, this kind of open, raw, direct experience. I don't know if it's very rich, or it's also just maybe too rich for us, you know? Or maybe it's just we're so habituated to shutting down and reaching conclusions about things. This is something to examine too, why we do that.
And I was noticing with that, we can't, it's very hard to relax with that experience. Mm. In the sense, like, we want to jump from it. Mm-hmm. And I think that it seems to me that's what you're really, as you were talking earlier, that's what kept coming to mind, is that it's the relaxing component. As we're looking, how can we relax with it without jumping,
right.
Without labeling?
Yeah.
You know, is it there or is it not there? Do we find it? Do we not find anything?
Yeah. Yeah.
Is there a Tibetan word for tolerance about this?
Mm-hmm.
Is that the word that they use?
Zupa.
Is that you can tolerate this, this unresolved aspect?
Yeah. Zupa is a word. It's actually the word for patience. But Pal Trumchi, in the words of my perfect teacher, says that the highest form of the paramita of patience is the ability to bear that it's empty. What we're talking about here is emptiness. Emptiness means that things can't be one-dimensional. They can't be a thing. So Herbert Gunther was one of the first Tibetan translators, or one of very important Tibetan translator from Tibetan to English and many other languages, but he, instead of one-dimensionality, he called emptiness open-dimensionality. I think that's a nice descriptive translation, that everything is open-dimensional, because it's all, you can't really find it, and yet, you know, everything is dynamic and open to interpretation, and we all see things differently, and it's elusive and changing and relative. So whatever you look at, it is open-dimensional, it's limitless. It's part of the great nature of infinite contingency. Like, everything leans, so you can't really pinpoint it or grasp it. But that doesn't mean it's a void. It just means that actually, quite the contrary, that it's infinite. Therefore, you can't capture it. So, Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah.
I can't get beyond the fact that when I start looking, I'm a looker, you know?
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of where I'm hung up.
Yeah. Tomorrow yes. I'm going to do, I'm going to look. Yeah, you absolutely have to look for the looker. And that's tomorrow. I just thought, I don't know, I wanted to just look at the nature of thoughts today. For some reason, I use the self. Usually I don't. Usually I use a, I try to get people to find their thing. Like if you have a thing, a difficult thing, sometimes it's nice to look for that. For some reason, I didn't do that tonight. But you know that, do you know the expression, like, don't make it a thing? This is what we do. We make it a thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, don't make a thing out of it, or don't make it a thing. Like, we have, it's just so much happening. It's so rich, and then we just make it a thing, or we make somebody a something, you know? And we don't, there we get trapped, and that's kind of the delusion part of it. But yes, it's very important to even look at the awareness and what that is. I have a feeling, what's your name, Annie?
Amy.
I don't know. I had a feeling maybe your question had to do a little bit with that, too. Did it? Like, what's looking? Is that your question?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that needs to be definitely examined. Are you going to come tomorrow night? Okay, I promise to. So we'll look, feel, smell, and experience that.
Spirit. Do it. Because we need to make sure we're actually doing it.
Doing
otherwise,
what?
Doing it.
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 Yeah.
Investigate.
Yeah, we need to make sure we're doing
the investigation. Make sure we're doing the investigation, because otherwise, if we're not clear about how to do it, right?
Yeah.
Won't be able to not find anything.
Right, right, exactly.
That would be a bummer.
That would be a bummer. So we need to use the it's and the things and all this in order to do it.
Right.
And that's fine. Just know that they're, you won't be able to find them when you really look. You know what I mean? Isn't that odd? Like, would you say, come here? But there is no here. But it works perfectly. They come here. I mean, if they listen to me, if they obey my command to come here. Not, I'm not talking about you now, Phil. I would never command you in that way. Don't you find that interesting? I can't get over that. That it's just like an approximation. It's just like this beautiful, magical illusion that words are created and we're functioning based on those. And like we can also wake up based on those, and we can use those. There's no problem whatsoever as long as we don't think that that's some reality to it. I just can't get over it still. After all these years,
I love your word magic that you can use, because that feels very, very true. And I liked what you said about I'm not sure that I'm not finding either.
Because
I work a lot with kids, even though I'm both teachers, and we have kids who use this word whatever. sometimes I want to say no, not whatever. There's something very specific, and it's there's a. I was talking today with students about this German philosopher Martin Buber and his idea of the higher path. And there's something very specific in that. There's something. There's a sense of an I, and there's a sense of a thou, of a relationship that's quite specific. But it's not. It's not. It is magic. Really. It's not. It's not the I. There's something more to it. There's a different kind of presence to it. But it's not whatever. It's not vague. In a certain way. So it's hard to. It's very hard to say what it is or isn't.
Yeah. I appreciate you saying that, because it's true. There's something. I often say that there's something very specific about this. It's not just anything. You know, Longchenpa says, I hope I can, if I can't remember it perfectly, I'll bring it tomorrow because I have it on my computer. Things arise as nothing whatsoever, no, things arise as anything whatsoever, but are something like nothing at all. They're nothing at all, but arise as anything whatsoever. Like, as long as there are causes and conditions for something to arise, they can arise. there's no causes and conditions, they won't arise. But look at this world. I mean, it feels like anything can happen, you know? And it's not just arbitrary either. You know, things arise due to interdependence. And so this is, it's like why we have to explore so much how the path works. It's like if you are self-focused, the fruits will be different than if you're generous or compassionate, you know? It's not just anything, you know? And this kind of investigation, too, is extremely clear and, like, investigative and based on, like, what you see. It's not just leaving it a vague spirituality. Yeah, that whatever thing would, I would probably, I could see how that could be something to address with kids. I think it's important. Things matter. Really, really matter. And that comes up a lot tomorrow, how much things matter. Yeah. But I think tonight's, you know, what I want to talk about is just explore a little bit the nature of thought, to appreciate discernment, to honor, really honor discernment, and to know that we can use our conceptual mind in this way that's, you know, just completely supportive, even though there's no truth to it. You know? Like, why do things have to be true to function? This is a big question. Apparently, they can function quite well without truth. You know? Because this is all happening, you know? So it just makes us look at things in a different way, I guess, it seems. Yeah. This, will you be here tomorrow night?
Yeah.
Okay, because the investigation is on permanence and impermanence, so it's a lot to do with time, but I will say, you know, it seems that time is a collective agreement. And, you know, the people who are in charge of keeping time, for example, in this country, say that, and they have a lot of trouble keeping time running at an accurate pace, they say. But they try really hard, and they're always looking for new technologies to make that happen. Like, if you have a clock up at a high altitude, it won't tick at the same pace as a clock at a lower altitude. So it's a very sensitive system that we're trying to maintain. There's this whole thing about this new way of keeping time, but they're having trouble getting it, you know, perfected. But it will never be perfected because we live in a world of relativity. You know, so something will always influence that kind of accuracy. But yeah, they would say time is a construct that we agree on. And then we all set our watches. Great question. Really good questions and contemplations. Yeah. I think we're out of time. So Peter's going to...
We'll recite the Long Life Prayers and Dedication of Merit, the last two pages of our book.